Hello and welcome. I'm Dandy Zhu, and you're listening to Digital Health Forward, a podcast dedicated to sharing the stories of healthcare entrepreneurs, leaders, and executives who are moving the digital health industry forward. Today, I had the chance to chat with Kelsey Millard, founder and CEO of Sitka. Sitka is a peer-to-peer asynchronous video messaging platform and specialist network. Sitka connects clinicians to top specialists, alleviating the challenges of scheduling and geographic limitations, and compressing the cycle of care by enabling rapid decision-making. Sitka is backed by Optum Ventures, First Round Capital, Rock Health, Homebrew, Box Group, and LifeForce Capital. Prior to founding Sitka, Kelsey also held positions at Honor Home Care, NaviHealth, United Health Group, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, and the Kaiser Family Foundation. Hey, Kelsey.
Hello, Dandy. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for taking time to be on the show. I'm really excited to learn more about your story and how Sitka came about.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to share as much as I can and to be as helpful to the audience.
Wonderful. So to start, would love to hear a little bit more about your background and your journey through healthcare and the digital health world. And then what led you to start Sitka? Would love to hear more about the inception story as well.
Yeah. So my journey in healthcare has taken lots of twists and turns, like most people's career. I actually grew up in the Midwest in Lawrence, Kansas. My mom was a pediatric occupational therapist. And so my first insight into healthcare was watching her mold splints on our stove in the evenings for her pediatric patients. And so that was really where I got to see on the front lines, like what it was like to be a frontline provider through the lens of actually my mother. So, you know, like many people thought that medical school was definitely going to be the route. And of course, also like many people decided that one-on-one patient care was not going to be a sustainable career for me because of my desire to have an impact at a more global level. And so that really led me into policy. And so I started out at Kaiser Family Foundation, which is an incredibly, you know, well-respected organization straight out of graduate school to do analysis on state health facts. So got really intimately familiar with some of the work that they do and really deep exposure to a lot of the public policy forums that they create. That felt a little too far away from the front lines of delivery of healthcare though. And so I actually went back to the Midwest and was a fellow at a pediatric hospital and really got to appreciate the complexity of what it's like to run an entire pediatric hospital. Everything from sitting in bond rating meetings with the city to, you know, riding a life flight helicopter. Through that experience, really got hooked on the nitty gritty complexity of frontline care delivery, whether that was reimbursement, trying to alter patient behavior, and ultimately trying to create this incredible experience for people that's rooted in the management of expectations of service. Joined the advisory board company, which led me back out to the DC area, was there for several years and loved working on, you know, individual hospital and systems revenue cycles. And so starting to really deeply understand the complexity of a revenue cycle inside, whether it was a critical access hospital or a large multi-hospital metropolitan system. At that time, also Obamacare had just passed. And that was a really unique opportunity to join the federal government and be employee number 5 at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And that was an incredible experience. We got to build our entire stakeholder engagement interface of how we were going to engage with members of our communities, hospital CEOs, you know, health plan CEOs, and really change from a regulator mindset to a partner mindset. With the industry, we actually got to build, you know, models like ACOs and bundled payments, and of course, hire a slew of people inside the federal government, many of whom have stayed actually through several administrations to really continue to develop and refine all of the alternative payment models to really drive value. From the federal government, I transitioned in private sector and decided to go work at United Health Group and was fortunate enough to be a vice president at the UHG corporate level and got to see the complexities of what it's like to run, you know, now a Fortune 6 company within two arms of United Healthcare and Optum. Was recruited away from United Health Group to join Tom Scully and the team at NaviHealth to help build out bundled payments. And that was really exciting to me because it introduced the intersection of frontline care delivery, the complexity of reimbursement, and ultimately, you know, transitions of care, which at the time was a pretty uncharted territory in regards to best practices and protocols to achieve the outcomes that we were after. From there, we were acquired by Cardinal And at that point, I was recruited out here to the San Francisco Bay Area, where I currently reside, to join the team at Honor. And so I was at Honor for over 2.5 years. We found product market fit. And really, that was my foray into, you know, Silicon Valley and more of the tech scene here in the Bay Area. One of the unique things about the Bay Area is that it's completely normalized to start companies here. It's just what people do. And so the itch came to fullness when I started advising a company that took on bundled payments in the ambulatory surgery setting, met one of their lead clinicians and started to really tinker with the optimization of his patient flow as a specialty physician. So that's really where the idea of Sitco was birthed, was inside a clinic of a primarily musculoskeletal related practice in Monterey, California. And so that brings us to today, 3 years later, of the concept of Sitco.
Wow. It's really amazing to hear about the variety and range of experiences you've had, from policy to the front line to working as a consultant and doing innovation at a federal level. So I'm really excited to hear more about Sitco and how some of those previous experiences have also informed the way that you are building this current company. How did you know at the time that this was the point in your career that you wanted to start a company yourself versus, say, join another one?
Yeah, I think that's a multifaceted question, right? Because it's not just about your career, and it's really about where you are. For me, it was really about where I was in life. And so I had 2.5 years of the Bay underneath my belt. I was feeling pretty settled. I started to navigate the scene here in the venture scene. So I felt like I had at least a toolkit, an adequate toolkit, like a version one of a toolkit to be incredibly dangerous when thinking about starting a company. And so I'd seen, you know, Seth Sternberg and the founders at Honor navigate that and was fortunate enough to be really exposed to that. I had similar exposures at Navi Health with Welsh Carson and, you know, the private equity world at Navi Health as well. And so, and personally, I felt like I could take on the quote risk, right? And I think that's what really allowed me to have deeper confidence that this was the right time to try it. There's no kids in the picture. Like, there isn't mouths to feed or responsibilities really beyond myself that I needed to tend to. And so I didn't feel like I would be negatively impacting anyone should it not work out. That was kind of really the multifactorial approach that led me to believe that now is the right time. And of course, there was also partner. There were eventually developed two partners in this journey to help co-found the company. And that was really important as well, because I think it's very different to start something on your own versus with partners who can provide greater levels of expertise or deeper insights in specific areas that you're not as comfortable with. So for me, those areas were on the software engineering side, which I have no experience as a professional in. And then, of course, on the clinical side. And so I felt leveraging what I had in the areas of expertise that I had and then finding complementary talent to round it out was really a recipe that felt like it was a doable one to bite off at the time.
That makes a lot of sense. And it seems like there was also a validated need in terms of working with this musculoskeletal clinic in the beginning as well. Before we deep dive into Sitco as a company, I wanted to discuss a little bit about what we're seeing currently in the industry when it comes to the role of telehealth in care delivery. So earlier in 2020, we saw CMS announcing new payment models designed to transform primary care by paying providers more for outcomes rather than just fee for service. And amongst those, direct contracting has been one that has been seeking to transform fee for service and reduce provider burden while empowering the beneficiaries to personally engage in more of their own care delivery. Mm-hmm. And so as we think about these provider organizations that are trying to take on these alternative payment models, it's, you know, touted that technology can be extremely helpful in doing that and managing patient populations, but also in managing coordination of care. And so from your perspective and from your experiences, would love to hear about how you see technology being used right now to advance value-based care and what challenges you think still lie ahead when it comes to providers taking on risk effectively.
So let's take the first one on provider adoption of technology. And I'll share an experience with you on that, which is it was week 2 of the pandemic and the start of lockdown. Of course, here in California, we were one of the first states to experience the level of lockdown that that eventually other states have adopted at various points. During that time, I was, of course, talking to many of the people in our pipeline to partner with, many at-risk primary care groups who were now faced with building virtual access overnight. And there was one conversation that really struck me, which was I was talking to a chief medical officer and I said, you know, how are you guys doing on telehealth? What's going on and what are your priorities? And his response was, Kelsey, you know, telehealth has been on our roadmap for 4 years and we need it tomorrow. And so I think that level of adoption and that perspective of shift of this is not a nice to have anymore, meaning using technology to deliver care, high quality care and reaching members where they are is absolutely not a nice to have anymore. It's a must have. And it's a must have because it feeds the revenue cycle. Prior to COVID, it was sitting on the edge of the revenue cycle. It was cool. There's a billable code. You could maybe make it work. And with the relaxation of some of the rules from CMS and this broader acknowledgement that the only way to deliver the volume of care that we need to, of high quality care, telemedicine was one of the only ways to do that safely. So that's really how I've seen specifically telehealth be rapidly adopted over the course of the past year as a result of, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic. I think that pace is going to continue to grow. We also see not only adoption of these tools, but also we see a lot more tools and companies popping up every day. So there's also a wave of companies that are taking advantage of the buying power of the market to actually start a new company. Now, that's also going to be met with increasing fraud and regulatory burdens as we start to settle into somewhat of this new normal where we've now trained our consumers and our members that they don't necessarily have to come to the clinic anymore. And perhaps maybe they shouldn't for some of the care that they're seeking. And so it is opening up this whole other aspect of our industry that we just haven't seen brought forth thus far in the adoption and the utilization of high value technology that is essential to a provider work. So that's how I've seen technology shift. And I actually just did a webinar presentation last week with the legal counsel of Doctor on Demand and our insurance guy from Gallagher, really around the regulatory environment and also the fraud, waste, and abuse environment that perhaps we'll start to see more of, unfortunately, in the telehealth space. So that's what I see happening on the adoption and the utilization side. I think on, you know, this value-based care concept and specific to your mention of DCEs, the direct contracting entities, you know, this is another massive wave that's similar to an ACO or a bundled payment, which gives providers an on-ramp to take on risk. And so I think we've learned a tremendous amount, and we being the entire industry, about what are the necessary tools to manage risk? And I think generally speaking, we're getting better, and data is telling us that this is true, that we're getting a lot better at managing, you know, a length of stay or a transition of care and really trying to deliver as much high value care through our primary care providers. Companies like Aledade, who are really helping providers across the country develop the toolkit necessary for them to maintain their own practice and take on risk successfully, as opposed to just get bought up. The M&A activity is continuing to increase at a rapid rate. We're experiencing that across the country as well. The utilization of technology aligned with the delivery of value-based care is only going to increase as we all continue to really build the acumen that's necessary in order to do this in a sustainable way with the right partners.
And I think the story of the CMO who said that this is now a must-have is something that rings true across many hospital systems. And as we think about telehealth, it spans so many different technologies and use cases and provider workflows. How do you usually provide context or help providers understand sort of what are their priorities when it comes to different types of telehealth solutions? What types of things do they need to really start ramping on to sooner rather than later? And what things can layer on perhaps after?
Yeah, I mean, a very cut and dry way to look at it is if you look at their P&L, where do they generate the majority of their revenue? And if it's currently on in-person visits so that they can capture coding metrics and things like that, then that should probably be priority. So how do they replace those in-person visits with virtual visit capability that is synchronous and still reaching the member? One of the things that we've seen in the industry, of course, especially when you're thinking about working with Medicare and Medicare Advantage and dual eligible populations, is tech literacy and availability of technology is not a universal period. There's no standard today that exists that everyone has X or Y. Part of it has to be when you're considering the adoption of telehealth is, what are the tools and modalities, and how are you potentially deploying the actual device so that you can increase the connectivity to your members? I know that Humana and Dr. Will Schrank have programmed that they actually send a tablet to their members ahead of the appointment. So it's almost, the analogy that came to mind for me was the Netflix, right? You like get your, you know, version one of Netflix, right? You get your DVD in the mail, you use it, and then you return it. That similar concept, which is delivered via snail mail of a iPad to facilitate a video visit, is not to be overlooked. And I think that's one of the challenges with the adoption of technology is that I think people think about a lot of the really neat cutting edge portions that technology can really expedite in the delivery of care and help inform it. But we can't go there unless there's a basic machine to help facilitate that AI algorithm, for instance. And so I think to your point, which is how do people prioritize this? I think you can't overlook the basic points of connectivity. And we see this across some of the senior housing communities that we're a part of and that we work with and that I'm affiliated with in my work with the National Investment Center on Senior Housing, which is some of these facilities are full of like concrete cement blocks and they can't transmit Wi-Fi. This is a really important step when you're thinking about a telehealth strategy, which is, that's great that you have this app and that's going to connect them to your physicians and allow for prescribing and, you know, reviewing of perhaps remote patient monitoring and all of these neat things that exist. But if you can't actually reach that person in a trustworthy way, then none of the rest doesn't matter. And so that's what I would encourage people to think about, which is basics first. This is no exception of that rule.
I agree with that. It actually reminds me a lot of a statistic I recently read about how even 50% of Americans currently do not have stable enough broadband connectivity to have a telehealth visit, which was astonishing to me. But it seems like there are a number of players who are also working on those problems. But hopefully with the foundation, with the basics of connectivity in place, we can really fully utilize the potential of telehealth in the coming years.
Exactly.
When it comes to Sitka, I'd love to hear more about the main problems that you're hoping to solve and what alternatives existed for primary care physicians and providers before Sitka was on the scene.
You know, at Sitka, given that we were born out of a specialty physician's office, one of the things that's really important that we're solving is, how do you bring specialty expertise to the front lines where most care is delivered? And so the way that looks functionally is that we partner with at-risk primary care groups, whereas opposed to sending that patient or that member out to see a specialty provider where they may wait 6 to 8 weeks to see that provider, they may require transportation coordination. That member may incur an out-of-pocket copay, which can become quite burdensome. We deliver all of that insight from our specialty physician network to the front lines via video. The video consult premise is really, really important if you think about where we've been in healthcare. Everything has been quite opaque. There's not a lot of visibility. If you want your patient records, good luck. You might end up paying a dollar per Xerox copy page. And a premise that's really important to me and our team is, how are we creating trusted interactions that actually increase the unification of this patient and the provider to actually deliver really high quality trusted care? If you talk to any, you know, patient in the healthcare system, you know, the doctor-patient interaction today in brick and mortar can be extremely stressed. And you can leave, especially with specialty visits, you can leave with more questions than answers. And so we wanted to kind of hit pause on that anxiety-producing experience where you've waited 6 to 8 weeks, you've probably waited an hour in a waiting room, and say, how can we really actually bring that expertise to the people who have the most interaction with these patients, which are primarily capitated primary care physician groups? We partner with those groups to really deliver frontline insight from our network, which really align with the top Medicare spend buckets, so that in a video-based consult and a video response from the specialty provider, they have what they need. They're not locked behind an EMR doing pipe-based data entry, and they're instead verbalizing the situation, perhaps even including the patient in that consult request. And then, you know, our network of providers respond back via video within several hours in a way that that video can ultimately be shared with that patient. And so we use what's called the peer-to-peer model, where we're practicing medicine across state lines, really relying on those frontline primary care providers to maintain the doctor-patient relationship and using insight from our network to expedite diagnosis, advance the initiation of a value-based care plan, ultimately to achieve better outcomes at a lower cost. So that's the premise of what happens pre-Sitka for a patient and post-Sitka for the patient experience and ultimately the provider experience. So we're upskilling the physician just in time so that they can deliver that care. Now, before Sitka, there have been some historic players in the market that are really focused on the educational side of the value of an e-consult. And so these consults are anonymous in nature. They're typically stripped of PHI, which could shift the reliability of a high quality consult, and they're text-based, and you don't know who's responding to your consult. And so that kind of, to me, flies in the face of trying to create more trust and transparency when we're continuing to lock things inside a text-based EMR with no kind of latch to expose this to the patient so that they feel the provider is acting on their behalf and that there's higher level of confidence and that the patient will actually adhere to the care plan based on the video response from that other provider. So we're really grateful that e-consults have existed in the market to help educate the market on the value of a consult model. And even then, there's been a lot of informal, you know, what's historically been called a curbside consult. And that's where if we were both physicians, maybe I would call or text you. There'd be no appropriate documentation inside the EMR, and you're actually exposing yourself to greater legal liability because of the lack of documentation. Whereas because all of ours is recorded and able to be reviewed thoroughly, we're actually reducing the risk of medical malpractice because we're not just describing what the symptoms are for the patient, but perhaps why they're existing and what can be done next. So that's really how I think about the landscape in general of consults and where we're going. While we are incredibly focused on aligning with our Medicare beneficiaries and high value-based care, and you can imagine the network effect that starts to get created when we align with value-based care and outcomes so that we're actually deepening the value that we're providing to our partners.
Got it. And just to dive a little bit deeper into how the consult is actually working, when the PCP initiates one, what sort of information are they attaching or including to send over to the specialist? And then how long does that usually take for them to receive a video response?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, a typical video consult request, of course, depends by specialty, but on average, a video consult request is around 3 minutes. And so that includes verbalizing, you know, typical H&P, anything remarkable about the patient. And then again, by specialty, attaching appropriate documentation. So for most musculoskeletal related consults, we have typically an MRI or an X-ray image, something like that. For a lot of endocrinology consults, we typically have labs. For dermatology, it's typically pictures, right? And so we've created a platform which allows for uploads of all types of documents so that the comprehensiveness of the clinical situation is described in great detail. Because this is a classic product question that I think many people will resonate with, Dandy, which is garbage in equals garbage out. And so if we're not setting up that primary care provider for success to get a high quality consult back from our specialty provider, then we're not doing our job. And so that's the basic premises that we think about when defining the clinical pathway, when we do integrate into EMRs for providers to use and launch Sitka from within their current workflow. Your second question was around turnaround time. And so our turnaround time is within hours. But I think that's less important than what we actually hear from the providers that partner with us. So when I'm out talking to primary care providers, well, when I used to be out and about doing that, now we're doing that on Zoom and other. When I ask what's the best thing about Sitka, of course, I also ask the counter of what would they like to see improved. And one of the things that they like the most is just the fact that it's reliable. They're like, I always get an answer from you, from your specialist via video. And that's an incredibly soothing part of the product experience. And so what that really gets to is there's very little that's reliable in the healthcare delivery system today. And the fact that that's one of the kind of high points for the providers, I think is indicative of where we are from a performance standpoint with utilization of technology and expectation management across the board. It's a bit of a sad response to me because of it's just indicative of where we are. And it's also really insightful, right? That this is something that's incredibly reliable that they can depend on in their workflow. And that gives me a lot of joy to know that we're actually helping and answering the questions that they have on behalf of their patients that they're attending to.
Yeah, I also thought it was interesting that you mentioned that the videos are often shared with the patients. Have you heard any feedback on how the patients are receiving these videos and how that's sort of changed their experience with their PCP?
It's been a pretty remarkable and joyous discussion when we talk to patients who do get these videos. What happens is that it's kind of like this idea that they get to kind of see behind the curtain, if you will. If your primary care physician says, hey, I'm going to go talk to a colleague about you. I don't know. Like, as patients, do we really think that that's happening all the time? Like, there's not a lot of validation at points in time in our delivery system that that's occurring, even though your provider may have the best of intentions, right? But let's think about that statement. They're not reimbursed for it, right? So they're not necessarily incentivized to do that, despite the good nature of them wanting to provide incredibly high value care to you. And so this is really important because you're unlocking a part of the healthcare system that has been locked behind kind of the EMR or behind the delivery system in general for so long. And so there's incredible delight from our patients who do receive these videos. And then ultimately there's greater adherence to the care plan that's developed because they feel like they're being really seen and tended to by this personalized video about them. It's their data. They get to watch it as many times as they want. And so it really shifts the power game in such a drastic manner that they're really starting to see different outcomes all across the board.
That's amazing to hear. And when it comes to the specialists and the relationships with the PCPs, do they end up going and sending consults to the same specialist that they previously interacted with, or is it sort of a different specialist every time?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And they typically, as long as they like that specialty provider and feel like that specialty provider is hearing them and providing high value-based care insights, then they typically get routed to the same one, unless, of course, they would prefer otherwise. That's been a really funny part of what's occurred on our platform, though, which is, you know, when humans are recorded, we frankly just act better. And I've noticed even I see this little recording button in the upper left-hand corner, and I'm probably talking slower than I typically would as a little cue. It's absolutely true for specialty providers and our PCP providers. The amount of thank yous and wow, that was really helpful. Great to see you again. Thanks for the thorough consult. It is amazing to us. And so that's been a really feel-good part of what we're creating, which is we're taking kind of this historic, I think if you talk to specialty providers and PCPs across the country, they've each had kind of raw experiences on requesting consults from both sides. That there could be this mentality that primary care providers don't know what they're talking about, which is why they have to have a consult, or the consult or the specialist is like, PCP, you didn't provide me with all of the adequate information. And it's much harder to make those perhaps unfair assumptions when you actually get to see the whites of someone else's eyes and you actually feel like you're partnered with them in the delivery and the care of this patient. And so that was a totally unintended consequence of building Sitka, was to create these lovely exchanges that are rooted in team and trust and admiration for one another. That's really brings a smile to our faces.
Yeah, it seems like you took something that previously was very transactional in nature, and now it's very relational. And it seems like there's a whole community that sort of formed out of this with all these relationships being built, which is really cool to see. Curious if you've seen any differences in behavior or adoption or utilization across specialties.
Yeah, so we have, absolutely. And I think it's regional variation. There's also variation of some capitated primary care groups employ a couple specialties of their own. And so, you know, when you look at the average Medicare beneficiary has 3 chronic comorbidities, the populations that we're working with have mostly over 5 chronic conditions. And so we are working with more acute population out of the gates, and therefore the utilization is different, and even utilization by specialty is different. And so, yeah, we absolutely see more of the chronic conditions, endocrinology and, you know, rheumatology. Some of these pop up frequently. And of course, you know, then there's dermatology, which varies by geography pretty drastically. And so we're starting to definitely think about the data set that's being accrued when we think about just like overall Medicare Part B spend and management and utilization, and where people are benchmarking against one another on that performance.
Got it. In terms of this year or the next couple of years, as you look ahead, what are some of the areas or opportunities for growth that you're most excited about and looking to expand into?
you know, we're really focused on continuing to prove the value. So we're going to be bringing on a head of ROI, which I think is a really neat role within healthcare that everyone talks about ROI and value. And until you assign, you know, an FTE to it, is it really being managed, right? That's kind of the question. And I think there are going to be roles like that that we continue to build out within our team to really help position us in the market to ensure that we're capturing the right outcome and having adequate and above adequate performance with amongst our partnerships across the country. And so we're really focused on continuing to grow our partnership base with high value-based organizations that are incredibly organized to launch tools like this for their frontline primary care providers. And then of course that can incentivize those providers to use them. And so that's what we're really focused on over the course of the next 12 to 18 months is as we continue on this journey. And really ultimately the question is, you know, are we having an impact every day? And as long as we're growing our impact every day, then I think we're on a pretty decent path.
On the point of value, I'm interested to hear what you've seen so far in terms of either improving health outcomes or decreasing costs. And how do you even go about measuring that and attributing it to vConsults?
Oh, the attribution question. So it's pretty easy if a primary care provider does a vConsult versus send that patient out to see an in-person specialty provider, the cost that is accrued on either one of those episodes. Because remember, our specialty provider is just informing that primary care provider's action. And so we're keeping the primary care provider at the helm of their patient's care and cost, right? That's the important thing here. Whereas when that primary care provider refers that patient out to see a specialist, they have no insight into the frequency of visits, into the number of labs or testing that's done. And they really have no control at that point in time. And so we've seen pretty drastic cost savings accrue on both by consult vertical, of course, and then of course on a per consult basis. We've also seen ER visits completely avoided because we're getting that insight within hours to that primary care provider. And so we're continuing to, you know, really assign metrics and value to every point in the process because it is multifactorial. It's not just one value metric that we're aligning with. And I think that's what makes this fun and also, you know, tricky as we think about that we're enabling access to specialty care. We're compressing the care cycle. We're eliminating low value care, which is of course reducing total cost of care management. We're upskilling the primary care providers just in time. We can enhance MA star ratings. And of course, doing that through the overall patient experience and management of that. And so I think those are things that we really think about when we think about assigning soft and more calculated value to the product and to the experience that we offer.
On the surface level, it seems like there would be a tension in terms of recruiting specialists to do these vConsults versus, you know, the specialists wanting the volume of referrals themselves. But clearly it hasn't been an issue in terms of being able to recruit these great specialists. I'm curious how you navigated that.
Yeah, you know, most of our specialty providers actually come via word of mouth, which I think really speak highly to the quality of experience that they have as providers on the Sitka Medical Associates Network. You know, there's no way for a specialty provider today to generate an income and not show up to their brick and mortar clinic unless it was, you know, for Sitka. And so I think the dynamic is shifting. And of course, a global pandemic has expedited that and also a elimination of potential elective procedures mid-pandemic also brought greater awareness to the diversification of income for this cohort of providers, you know, on average have 11 years of experience in the community of which they reside. And so these are not folks who haven't touched a patient for 20 years. These are active practitioners who are aware of best practices, who understand value-based care, who are providing these insights back to the providers. And it's really neat because since everything's recorded, right, we can continue to assess quality in a multifactorial way, which is really, really crucial as you're building credibility for a business.
Excited to see where things go in the next year and 18 months. Switching gears a little bit to our last part of the podcast, would love to hear some of the biggest lessons you've learned and insights you've gathered to date when it comes to innovating in the space. And tied to that, what sort of advice might you have for other entrepreneurs and founders who are looking to make an impact in healthcare?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because as you can imagine, the lessons learned is a quite, quite the healthy list. Some of the advice that, and I wish I could attribute this appropriately. I really don't recall who gave it to me, but they said, you know, it was like right when I was starting Sitka. So it didn't mean as much to me then either. I was like, oh, okay. Like I didn't really know what I didn't know yet. But they said, you know, nothing is ever as good as it seems or as bad as it seems. And I think as an entrepreneur, especially in healthcare, things can be incredibly difficult. Sales cycle, client management, recruiting talent, building the team, right? And when you're doing something that no one has done before, there's a lot of pressure in every single decision that's made about this product feature and do we mandate this? And I think keeping in mind that the days that feel really, really good are good. And the days that feel really, really bad are bad, but they're not really, really bad, right? And so I think keeping your mental health in mind in this journey is incredibly important. And narrowing the spectrum of great to terrible to just everything being a little bit more in the okay range is probably going to lend you down a better path that has more stability, not only for you, but your team. And then, you know, there's little tactical things, which you have to figure out what makes you tick. And for me, one of those things, I need to get outside. I grew up playing soccer. I played college soccer. I spent 3 hours a day outside. And that's really important to my soul and to my mind. And so carving out time to allow you to be your best so that you can show up in the best way you can for your team and for your investors and for your clients is really not to be overstated. So I think those are a few tricks of the trade to kind of keep things in check when you are on this journey that can be pretty windy.
Definitely. And the first part you mentioned about the nothing is ever as good or as bad as it seems really resonates. It reminds me of the first day of school, actually, when one of our professors drew on the board this chart where it showed, you know, overachievers basically are always in these extreme emotional states and reminding us to take care of ourselves and have more compassion. I love that you mentioned that as well.
Really important within how the team perceives you, right? And if you're showing up really hot or really cold, that impacts the entire culture, that impacts your clients, that impacts everyone else. And yeah, so being incredibly mindful about that has been a shift for me and just thinking about how I show up and interact with the incredible people that have joined this journey. I want them to have an awesome experience while they help us build something that's really important. So I think that just to elaborate ever so slightly on that.
Totally. Thinking about how your energy is influencing other people around you is so important. What are you looking forward to the most in 2021?
We're potentially starting to turn a corner. We have a couple of really happy clients. We're turning on several more. And so continuing to again, build the impact that we're having on a daily basis is what I'm most looking forward to. And there's lots of features of that, right? We're going to continue to build our team and continue to work with our investors and deepen those relationships as we start to understand and quantify the value that we're creating on the front lines of our delivery system across the United States every single day. And that's what I'm most excited about in 2021 is really how do we increase our impact through high value daily interactions with the providers that we're fortunate enough to partner with who are on the front lines every single day.
Amazing. Best of luck. Thank you so much, Kelsey, for taking time. This was a very insightful interview and I'm excited to hear feedback from our listeners.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Dandy. And yeah, best of luck to you and the rest of your educational journey as well.